Okay, so let us begin. My name is Donald D. Gasper, and I'll be the interviewer for the interviewee of Edward Fitzer, prefers to be referred to as Eddie Fitzer, and we are here on the 6th of October, 2001, on Saturday, at Mr. Fitzer's residence here in Bloomington, Illinois. And this is tape one, side A. And this oral history project is concerning the veterans of the air war over Europe during World War II. And this oral history interview is being conducted under the auspices of a graduate level course at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. Specifically, the course is Approaches to Oral History, History 447. And so at this point, I'd like to ask Mr. Fitzer to say his full name and spell it, if he would, just so we get that correctly for the records. And then after he does that, we'll stop the tape and play it back for a sound check. So, Mr. Fitzer, if you would, say and spell your full name, please.
Okay. Edward J. F. Fitzer, that's F-E-T-Z-E-R. And you want the serial number?
Well, you mentioned J.F.
John Frederick, two middle names.
I see. And you know your serial number still by heart. Yeah, what might that be?
Oh, yeah, it's A-O-732-456.
Very good. So, at this point, let's just make sure we do a sound check and see how we're doing. So, we'll stop the tape at this point. All right, we're back. We've done our sound check. Everything is sounding good. And let's go ahead and proceed. And or let's begin. First question, starting at the very beginning, if you would say, please, your date of birth and your place of birth. And then please tell me about your childhood, where you grew up, what you did as a child, and leading up to your entry into military service.
Hey, I was born April the 21st, 1921, at a little village of Richland, Illinois, which probably has an address now of Pleasant Plains, Illinois, which west of Springfield. We lived there until I was about 5 years old. Dad had sold the farm. We moved to Springfield. And we lived in Springfield about 5 years, and where I had then started to school, and in Springfield at Trinity Lutheran School, and I was I finished the fifth grade, and then when we moved back to the farm, I went sixth and seventh grade to a little country school.
You say you moved back to the farm. Is this
yeah.
you
Dad
returned
bought
to
another farm. No, another farm. He bought another farm then. Because
located where?
It was real close by the other one. It was a Pleasant Plains address, just 9 miles west of Springfield.
So basically moved back to Pleasant Plains
yeah,
in that
the address. Yeah. And so then I went to this country school, and then for the eighth grade, then sixth and seventh was there. Then the eighth grade, my sister was teaching nearby. So she went through Springfield and dropped me off on her way to school, picked me up on her way home, and I finished in the eighth grade at Trinity Lutheran School so I could be confirmed in church at that time. Then after graduating from the eighth grade, I went to the Pleasant Plains Township High School and graduated from there in 1939. And from there, I was on the farm with my dad until things begin to look like we were going to, well, get into a war. There was a war in Germany going on, and I had some friends that had, they were a couple years ahead of me in school, but they had gone out to San Diego and were working in the Consolidated Aircraft Factory. And I thought that would be a pretty good thing to do. So I went out then to see about that. And after getting there, I had a room with them in their boarding house, and I went on a Monday morning to Consolidated. I was immediately hired because they were looking for all kinds of people. I was supposed to go to work on a Wednesday morning. But that Monday evening, we were sitting around listening to the radio. That's where you didn't sit around watching TV because there wasn't any in those days. But anyway, there was an announcement that they were looking for flying non-coms. It was a new deal. They needed more pilots. And a man could go through and take pilot's training and graduate as a staff sergeant and pilot. And oh, well, that sounds like something interesting. So I went down the next day and enlisted in the Air Force.
Now, this was roughly what month?
This would have been September of 1941.
All right.
1941.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I enlisted in the Air Force, and I think it was right away then that I filled out the papers for this flying non-com thing. And but in the meantime then, in order to wait for this, I was inducted at Fort Rosecrans, California, outside of San Diego, and typical of the Army, they sent me back to Jefferson Barracks for indoctrination. Because if I'd enlisted in Illinois, they'd have probably sent me to California. But anyway, I went to back to Jefferson Barracks for indoctrination, and my choices were I could armament school or mechanics or radio. And mechanics was at Chanute Field, and radio, I think at that time, might have been at Scott Air Force Base. I'm not sure. But I didn't care for either one of those, so I chose armament, which was at Denver, Colorado. And after a brief period of time of normal Army go through checks and exams and stuff, I was sent to Lowry Field. And while at Lowry Field, I happened to be roller skating downtown Denver the morning of December the 7th. And four MPs came into the roller rink and said, "All service personnel is now ordered back to base immediately." And so we went back to base and sat around and turned on the radio and listened to Franklin D. tell us all about the war that was going to go on or was going on. So I did finish armament school. And
now, how long did that take, roughly?
Well, I forget exactly. I was there from just before Thanksgiving. I got out to Lowry, and then I went to, they sent me to Mitchell Field, Long Island, for armament work. And that would have been in the spring. I was out in Denver all that winter, January or so before I went to, or February when I went to Mitchell Field. But in the meantime then, while I was at Denver, then an announcement came through that they were needing more pilots. And even though I had my papers in for flying non-com, if a person would take the equivalent exam of 2 years of college, you could get into the cadet corps and graduate a second lieutenant and pilot. So I checked on that and asked about the deal, and they said, what if I fail this exam? They said, it doesn't matter. Your name's in the file. When your number comes up, you'll be called for flying non-com. So 60 of us took that exam, and 15 of us passed. And it was the equivalent, it wasn't an easy test, but it was the equivalent of 2 years of college, which qualified you for cadet school. Well, so I didn't hear much from that until I was at Mitchell Field working in armament, which was, I was working on fighters there with machine guns, and we didn't have many bombers at that time, but we knew all about bomb racks and stuff. And one day the squadron commander called me in, and he said, "Mr. Fetzer," he says, "how's come you didn't let me know you were going to be a cadet?" He said, "I made a private first class out of it." I said, "I don't care about being a private first class. I want to be a second lieutenant." So he said, "Well, here's your papers. You're supposed to go to Maxwell Field, Alabama." So I went to Maxwell Field, and Then we were around there for, three or four days. Again, one of those things that's where we first learned how to be a cadet. You ate your meals in a figure eight and a square meal, and you did not look your eyes up from the table, or you'd be hollered at and looked down. Mister, do not look around. You want to buy the place? We had all kinds of hazing. They'd come in at our barracks at night and haze us, tell us jokes, and if we laughed, they'd say, "Rip, wipe that laugh off your face. Go wash it down the stool." You'd have to take your hand and wipe your face off and throw it down the stool and flush the toilet. And it was just regular hazing.
So now, for someone who hasn't heard of a square meal, that's where you have to take right
take
angles
right
to your
angle,
mouth.
Right, uh-huh.
Very regimented.
Or a figure eight, too. You had to do a figure eight now then.
Very regimented way of eating.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. It was just more or less, it was a hazing process. And the same when crossing a street. I mean, you had to stop and look both ways or they'd get you.
Well, one thing I'd just like to double check as now we're getting into your your military training phase and that sort of thing. I just to step back a second, I'd just like to make sure in your growing up and being on the farm and that sort of thing, to what extent, of course, you ended up being in the Air Corps, the Army Air Force. To what extent did you have exposure to flying that might have, you know, as you grew up, that might have influenced you joining, how you ended
up? I don't
up?
Know nothing. It's just that I knew I didn't want to be a ground soldier and crawling around in a trench, and I thought it'd be better if I was flying. And main reason, no flying background at all, just that I always enjoyed watching the planes and so forth, but I just didn't want to be a ground soldier, that's all.
And as I recall, we talked about, you know, you growing up, and I just would like to make sure, now you a farming community, you didn't have a family background of military?
None whatsoever, no, none, no. I had two sisters, and my father was, at the time of World War I, he was, I don't think he even registered. I think he was beyond the age at that time because he was 40 when I was born. And but he never did register for the draft or anything. So none of our family was anywhere near the military at all. It was just that we were getting into a war, and I thought it'd be better to volunteer than to sit back and be drafted, mainly.
Yeah, right. And what, I believe I've heard the phrase that the people who joined before Pearl Harbor got Eager Beaver designation.
Yes, right here. That's called an Eager Beaver ribbon. That's pre-Pearl Harbor.
Oh, as you're pointing to your little, or I shouldn't say little, but your display case of various medals during your military service, and I will go ahead and take a picture of that just so I can include that display with the other materials concerning this oral history session. I'll be sure to take a picture of that. And let me just mention one other administrative point, I guess, is that just to make note that we began our interview at approximately 2:30 in the afternoon here on the 6th of October of 2001, just as a way of background of the circumstances of this interview. So anyways, pardon that, just that checking of your family mm-hmm. background in that aspect. But you were saying then you were in your cadet phase and in the hazing and all that, mm-hmm. so please continue.
Well, before that though, going back just a little bit, I would like to say that one of the things too that with this Eager Beaver ribbon, by volunteering was rather disgusting in a way, because as a volunteer, as a private first basic buck private, I got $21 a month. All the fellows that were in the service with me that were drafted were getting $30 a month. Mm. I didn't think that was quite fair, but that's the way it was anyway.
Like much in the military, fairness is
yeah,
not
right. That didn't count. Yeah. Yeah. So, I was at, as a cadet then at Maxwell Field. We were there for, I don't know, really maybe a month or so, and then for some reason or other they sent us to Selma, Alabama. And while I was there, then it was decided, and right about that time then, they didn't need pilots too bad. In fact, in the cadet school, this word was out that, boy, one little goof up and you were washed out. So I didn't think that was too good a deal. And then there were other things you could volunteer for, so I picked out bombardier training. And so then, because of the bombardier training, I was sent to Santa Ana, California. Nobody knew exactly why we were there, and didn't do much of anything but stand formations and so forth. You know, Santa Ana is just outside of Los Angeles. So we did have time to get into Los Angeles on weekends and stuff.
Okay, so now speaking of time, you said you had a month at Maxwell, and then you went to Selma for some period of time.
They're real close together, really. Selma, Alabama is close by Montgomery.
Yeah. Okay, so you were in Alabama for roughly...
Oh, I'd say a month or two.
Okay, and then you went to Santa Ana, California, and you were there for how long?
In Santa Ana, I'm not sure how I was there either. It was just, for one thing, I didn't realize until years later that when I arrived at Williams Field, which is Chandler, Arizona, outside of Phoenix, that we were about one of the first groups on the base. And I think that's one reason I stayed in Santa Ana as long as I did. They were kind of waiting for that base to be open. It was an advanced pilot school and bombardier training, both. At Williams, In fact, one of my acquaintances while I was there, I happened to run into a famous man at that time, was Tommy Harmon from the University of Michigan, one of the great football players of all times. And I kind of got acquainted with Tommy a little bit. But
Well, just again, to make sure I understand the timeline here. So you went to Santa Ana... what would you roughly when that might be? Month, year? Or let's put it this way, when did you go to Williams then? Roughly. Just to get an idea of your training time, that sort of thing. We could always fill in the transcript on some elements of that.
Let me get back here.
Well, I see you're looking through your, you have some documentation here as we're talking.
A little bit, but not too good of dates on it.
Okay. Well, that's okay. We could always fill in the timelines at another
time. Williams
Field,
if this is dated. Well, I know I left Williams October the 31st. Of 42, yeah, because I was in the class of 4215, which graduated October the 31st, 1942.
Okay, and that's when you completed your bombardier training.
Yeah, that's when I was made an officer and by an act of Congress a gentleman. Took an act of Congress to do it, but I was
qualified.
Officer and a gentleman, now on October 31st, 1942. Right.
Yeah, Second Louis.
Right, Second Lieutenant.
All right, and so then after completing your bombardier training on October 31st of 42, then you moved on to?
They sent me to Fort Myers, Florida, which was an air base on the coast and wasn't much going on. That's when I first was introduced to B-26s. So, and in those days, I don't know whether it still is or not, but you needed 4 hours a month flying time to get your flight pay, which was 50% more than the average base pay. I don't know whether that still holds true or not. But anyway, going to the flight line and trying to get in some flight time, one day they said, well, one of our planes just went down in the Atlantic on the other side of the bay. And then the next day I went down, well, we just lost one up out of Fort Myers here. So I think there was at least a month when I lost my flight pay. I couldn't get into flight. So then they had opened a new base at Avon Park, Florida. And I was sent up there then. By the way, at Fort Myers, there wasn't much of a base there. In fact, they put me up and all expenses paid. I lived in a pretty nice motel or hotel in downtown Fort Myers. And then at Avon Park is when they made us into crews, and that's when I met who was to be my pilot, co-pilot, and in fact our whole crew, engineer, radio operator, and gunner. So then for quite some time we flew Well, I would say that would have been probably, October, November. Here, I can almost show that. Here, let me go back to Avon Park here once. Same time home after graduation. So at October, December of 42, I started flying around, I guess it was in Fort Myers, Avon Park, Now, here was my report from the end of November. There was no time accomplished this month at Fort Myers. So then, December, I started flying out of Avon Park. And we just flew local missions, not really missions. I mean, I covered Florida every inch of it 14 times probably. We just make circles all over Florida and had different places. And at that time then too, as a bombardier though, in the B-26s, they decided to make navigators out of all of us. So mainly those flights were navigational flights. And I had a real great co-pilot. In fact, well, like I said, we lived together for 18 months and there was never a crossword between us. I mean, perfect gentleman from Georgia. And but he used to sit and look down his window. When I'd give him an ETA for an airport, he would wait till we got right at the middle of the airport and he'd watch his watch and he'd say, "Ed, you missed it 2 seconds." He was very critical.
So at Avon Park, then that's really when you were trained to earn the designation of a bomb nav, both a bombardier
mm-hmm.
and a navigator.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And at what point did that training get completed that you then had that designation?
Well,
roughly, what'd you
we
say?
We had that until from what I could gather here in my flight record, May the 3rd of 43. May the 3rd of 43. And that's when my orders show Selfridge Field, Michigan. So that's when they sent us to Augusta, Georgia to pick up a brand new airplane.
Well, B-26.
B-26, uh-huh. And we flew that around, two or three days maybe. And then our orders were to go to England. And to go to England, we went up the east coast to Goose Bay, Labrador. However, in so doing, when we got to close to New York, we were getting some engine problems, nothing serious but light. And the pilot says, "Where can we go?" And I said, "Well, I was stationed right out here at Mitchell Field." So we turned off to go to Mitchell Field. And we had been flying the airways, but as the minute we turned off the airways, we were jumped by four fighter planes. And we told them it was a mayday. We were headed for Mitchell Field because of engine problems. Well, they couldn't do much with us there, so they sent us to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which is an air depot. So we went to Harrisburg for, our problem, whatever it was, didn't amount to much. But while we were there, they discovered that something about a wing bolt. We either had a red bolt that was supposed to be blue, or we had a blue that was supposed to be red. So we were there for about a week with nothing to do but wander around town. And so then finally, they got our plane going again, and we took off for Goose Bay. Only we decided, well, we've wasted so much time now, let's just go back to LaGuardia and we'll spend the night in New York City. So we did that, and had a nice evening in New York. So then we took off for Goose Bay, Labrador. And then in Goose Bay, we were there about two or three days, just kind of waiting for weather. They finally gave us clearance, and they said, since you're not a qualified navigator, see, I didn't have any celestial navigation. I was only a dead reckoning, DR navigator. So they said, you'll have to follow that B-17. Well, we just kind of snickered and says, okay, we'll follow the B-17. Well, we had crossed the coast to Goose Bay, Labrador before that B-17 ever got warmed up. So we took off for Greenland anyway. And I DR'd the North Atlantic, which they said couldn't be done. But about halfway to Greenland, out over the North Sea there, was real easy to pick up a beam. So we picked up the beam from the Greenland Bluey West 1 and flew on in on that beam then. And by the way, the DR navigation there too was a little tricky when I started, because if you'll look at a map in that part of the country, you'll notice that the longitudinal lines come through pretty quick, and that's about how often you change course. You need to follow your right direction. You change course about every 5 minutes, really.
Just a double check. One of the details, you said you picked up the beam from Greenland from what station? You think you mentioned it.
Well, there it was, a station 162, they called it. I'm not sorry. That's not it. Bluey West 1.
Bluey West 1.
Yeah, Bluey West 1. It's the far west coast, pretty well south. There was another base north a ways, but this was pretty well to the southern part of Greenland. And it was kind of tricky because the base was in a valley like, and you flew in a cavern up over kind of a river like, and when you got in, you set it down on the runway, because while I was there, somebody had trouble with their landing and tried to go around, only they didn't get around. They smacked into the mountain on the other side on the end of the runway. But while we were there then, there was a way you could go around to the way south end of Greenland, or we could cross over the ice cap. Well, in the meantime, though, we had met up with a group that had just left Florida ahead of us, and they were going over as a group. And the old colonel, Carl R. Story, asked us what our designation was, and we said, we don't know. We're just going to England as lost replacement aircraft. That was what we were sent over as.
And that's why you were solo.
Just to fill in. Yeah, we were just going over by ourselves. So he says, well, heck, he says, I can always use another plane. Why don't you fellas join my outfit? We says, well, we don't know how to do that. He says, I do. So he made some calls or something or other, and in a couple of days he said, hey, you fellas are in my outfit. Go along with us now. So
and now that outfit was specifically the group and the squadron.
That's the group that I stayed with and during the war, yeah.
Right. And that designation?
Yeah, the 387th Bomb Group.
387th Bomb Group. And
556
you,
Squadron.
556 Squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And your nickname?
I don't think it had one.
Well, let's see. You had some sort of markings on your aircraft. The
not really. The only thing, our squadron commander, Colonel Ives, Walter Ives, and he was a character. Well, he had been in service. He had been, I think, in a tank corps or something, because he had his plane named the Gravel Agitator. And and we had our plane named Cuthbert, which we lost when we got to England, because it was a different number, different style plane that the colonel didn't like. So we got a new one when we got to England. But anyway, and there was no other, the squadron or anything didn't have any markings at that time.
Well, at that time, okay, I guess another thing I guess I should point out here, just to show some background on this interview, is in my studies, I conducted a summer internship at the Prairie Aviation Museum in the summer of 2001, and I had the opportunity to hear the very interesting recollections of Mr. Fetzer previously, and so trying to touch on some of the points that we talked about before this recording. I just thought at that time, unmarked or largely unmarked aircraft, but at some point you had some the stripes that were applied, not the D-Day stripes, but the squadron.
That was for the invasion.
Well, the black and white invasion
stripes. Yeah, we were
did you have some sort of other?
No, it was just a group marking. Each group had their own designation.
Yeah, or did they have a particular color on their tail?
Like the 386 was plain yellow. Ours was yellow with black stripes, the tiger stripe.
with a stripe going straight up or straight across?
Slantways.
Diagonal on your cap.
Diagonal.
That's what I was getting at. That like somehow your
model up there on the wall.
Your squadron. Right, your squadron aircraft had. Okay, I see your model over there with the diagonal yellow stripe on the vertical
tail fin
of the B-26 with black thin lines on each top and bottom of that yellow stripe.
Yeah.
So, okay, yeah, that's what I seem to recall now.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about, and then of course, right before the invasion, the D-Day invasion on the 6th of June, that you, I seem to remember you saying those stripes, the black and white stripes, were applied on the wings before.
Yeah, that
right,
was
right before.
Just for American planes, so we could identify each other, you know,
and
not get mixed in with a bunch of German fighters or something. Yeah.
Yes.
But then from on our way over, then, like I say, we crossed the ice cap. And unbeknownst at that time, in fact, I didn't know about it until, like, I don't know, 6 months or so ago, that this outfit had gone down in Greenland, the P-38s and B-17s, not too far from where we went over, because the weather was tricky. We were in Greenland 13 days waiting for the weather to go, and we flew the ice cap at 11,500. It was 11,000 feet high. We cleared the ice pack by 500 feet. And then we found out that this P-38s, after they went down in the 50 years that they were in Greenland, the ice had built up 258 feet.
Yes, as I seem to recall, there's been some media coverage about trying to recover those aircraft, which I believe was something on the order of six P-38s and a couple B-17s, which of course the ice has tended to crush considerably over time, but that... Right, that's now here in the last decade or so attracted much interest and, in fact, recovered at least one of the P-38s to try to restore. So you crossed the ice cap on your way to
to
combat.
Iceland.
Yeah.
To Iceland.
Iceland.
We went into Reykjavik, Iceland. And there we were just a couple of days in Iceland, I think mainly for one weather pattern. And from Iceland, then we went to northern Scotland, Scotland. Mm-hmm. Went into Scotland, and then down to Ireland in the next day or two, and then in Ireland, that's when they took our plane away from us, and we went over by transport to a station 162, which is at Chipping Ongar, England, about 40 miles northeast of London.
Now, why didn't they let you just fly on with the aircraft?
They left it there for some reason or other for training purposes or something in Ireland. And,
to give you a different aircraft
When we got to England, and then we got a different aircraft.
Could you say the name of that station 162 again, please?
Well, it's just station 162. It was at Chipping Ongar, a little town of Chipping Ongar. In that area, there was an Ongar, a High Ongar, and Chipping Ongar, at least, if not another one or so. I don't know where they got the names from.
Yeah, this is in vicinity of what other major town?
Well, the next biggest town was Chelmsford. I could see we were about roughly 40 miles northeast of London. Because while there, I mean, I made several trips into London. It was easy. We'd catch the train out of Chipping Ongar and buzz into London for weekends and so forth.
And so you arrived at your base in England, and this would
be... Yeah, we set almost a record there. From my calculations, we drew our airplane on May the 3rd, and we got to our base June the 26th. We figured if it was 29 days crossing the Atlantic, that's not a record.
So this is, of course, 1943.
Yeah, 43, yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know, but anyway, we got there. And then we flew around, quite a little bit, because, for one thing, the group that we joined had just been made up. The co-pilots, most of the co-pilots had just graduated from school, and they hadn't flown with the crew hardly at all. So mainly, while they were training with their crew and getting acquainted with the first pilot, the co-pilots mainly were getting acquainted, we just kind of flew around kind of on our own. They just let us go, and we just kind of toured England. And in fact, as a bombardier navigator, the pilots almost checked me out. In fact, I always figured if I was in an emergency, I would have tried to land a plane myself, as I had that much time in flying. But because it was from June then until our first mission was August the 9th of 43. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what was the target?
We were going down the coast of France. It was a quite interesting mission. We had gone straight across from about the White Cliffs of Dover in that area, gone over to France, and I'm not real sure what the mission was that day, because as we were going down the coast of France, kind of to our target, we were hit by flak. And I think it was the radio operator, because I was down in the nose already, and the radio operator had called back and said, "We've been hit pretty good." So I came back up out of the nose and checked and looked back in the bomb bay where we still had our bombs on board, but they looked like bottles in a bottle washer. I mean, a 2-inch hose under 15 pounds of pressure was squirting gasoline all over our bomb bay. So we decided it was time to try to get back to England. So we headed immediately to England, aborted that mission, and we got back over the channel. I salvaged the bombs, and just before we got to England, the pilot says, "I don't think we're going to make it. We're going to have to land in the water." And we were all set to land, and I was standing up between the pilot and co-pilot, and I says, "Right dead ahead is a little strip over there in England. Let's putter down." And we landed on this strip and got to the end of this little runway, which was barely long enough to accommodate our plane. The tower called back and says, "Well, taxi on up here to the hangar." And as we turned the plane around, it coughed twice, and we said, "We can't make it to the hangar. We are out of gas." And that mission was aborted, but it did count as a mission anyway. And so I don't know, they came down and got us from the base, and then it was a couple days till they got that plane patched up, and then we went back and got it again. And we picked it up then a day or two later.
Now clearly it was fortunate that with all that gas spewing about that nothing, no sparks set it off.
It's just, just lucky that it didn't blow, that's all, yeah.
So would you say, here's your first mission, and oh boy, what a...
That kind of made believers out of us, yes.
And would you say that was the closest call? Well, actually, I remember from one of our previous discussions during my internship, you talked about getting hit by a piece of flak that set you back.
Well, yeah, that was just, well, we had a lot of, almost always when we'd get back with a mission, they'd have to, if we flew the next day, it'd take all the mechanics all night long to patch holes in the planes. We'd bring them back in looking like top of salt shakers many times. And we got hit so often with flak.
Do you remember some of the, if they counted the holes, how many you might have?
No, I don't know. I know it was numerous. Some planes, I mean, were just really riddled, but they'd still fly. And that's when we started gaining confidence in the old B-26, because it would take a beating. And a lot of the guys, and really that probably, I mean, as close as we were hit, we could see, because basically going in then to a target area, we would hit evasive action. And at our altitude, 11 to 11.5, which we flew most of the time, you could watch the guns on the ground, you could watch the flash, and you knew you had about 12 seconds or so before that shell would get to your plane. So you'd wait till it flashed, then you'd alter course. So we'd be turning away, and here, boom, 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 upside of us would come all the shells. And a couple of times, they kind of surprised us. Mostly 88s, but one time particularly we were going in, And we didn't know what it was, because they were really booming and bouncing us around, and we found out after we got back they were throwing 105 millimeters at us. And they let us know they were up there. But we didn't have, and again, mostly flak, because we did not have fighter problems. Almost every mission we were escorted with fighters. Early in the war, we started out with mainly they were Canadians flying the English Spitfire. And then later on, they changed to P-51s. And then even later on then, not too long before the invasion...
No, but with the P-51s, that was American
units
then flying.
And then just before the invasion, they started giving us P-47 escorts. And because we went in, and they were all around us. I mean, it was quite, encouraging, because... the fighters, we could say in the distance we might see a few fighters, but they didn't come in, because we were just, the fighters were just, they'd circle us, go fly a circle around us and everything else. One day it was kind of amusing almost. We were going down, kind of almost the coast of France, and I don't know, I didn't see it, but my co-pilot happened to look out to the side, and he said, hey, it looks like an ME-101 flying side of us. And I could, by going way out into the nose and looking back, I could see, and I said, it is a 101. And we called
a 101 our... 101 or...
ME Messerschmitt.
Fighter?
Yeah.
Single engine fighter.
Messerschmitt fighter, yeah.
109.
And so we called to the turret gunner. We said, do you see that, Bob? Yeah, he says, I just now noticed it. He says, well, turn your guns on him. So Bob started to turn the turret towards him, and about that time the old German gave us a salute and peeled off. He didn't want any part of that turret coming at him. But I don't know what he was sitting out there for. He just flying alongside of us for quite a while.
Your remarks are prompting some other questions I have here on what you've been saying. Just to backtrack for a moment here, I was just curious, to what extent in your training, your bomb nav training, did you witness a washout rate of some folks or some of the personnel washing out for one reason or another, or going on to other things?
Not too much when I was in school. I don't remember of a classmate washing out.
I see.
Now, I could get into that when I came back and was an instructor. In fact, I was a flight leader after I got home. I had, in that time, when I went through school, we were two to a plane. We each had, the AT-11s had 10 bombs. We each had five. But when I came home then and got to be, I wasn't an instructor long, because of they called data rank, so I was made a flight leader. I had seven instructors and seven pilots under me, and 21 cadets. So we flew three cadets to a plane at that time. And one of the times I know that I think the instructor came to me and he says, it was up to me to give the guys a wash ride, as we called it. I mean, he was ready to wash them out. And I went up with them and I said, what's the trouble, guys? And they said, well, we don't know. And I said, let's see. One guy dropped a bomb, and I mean, he threw it clear out in the desert someplace. I don't know where it was. And at that time, they sent cameras along, so they took pictures of all the shots. And I called back to the guy with the camera. I says, give me that camera. So as he handed it to me, I dropped it. In dropping it, I accidentally threw it a little harder, too, on the floor, and broke it pretty good. So I said, okay, guys, let's do some more bombing. So I pulled what they call the old rake on them, and a couple more went out in the desert, and I put them in about 200 feet, and the guys looked down, and they began to grin, you know. And here, this before it was over with, those guys were throwing bombs right into the target, I mean. And I said, what's the matter with you guys? Well, instructor, he's been giving us a bad time. And I said, yeah, I can see that. So I went back, and I said... that instructor met me and he says, are you going to wash them out? I says, no, I'm going to give them a new instructor. And as far as I know, they went on and graduated. They did fine.
Another thing about the training phase and even into the combat phase, because you talk about how the B-26 took a beating repeatedly among your fellow aircraft and other aircraft you flew with. Of course, the B-26 was tended to get a reputation of, you know, the phrase one a day in Tampa
mm-hmm.
Bay and
yeah.
What was it, the Baltimore Hustler, because it looked like it had no visible
the
means of support, the
yeah.
flying prostitute,
yeah.
relatively short
uh-huh.
wings and
it was mainly the idea that I think when they kind of build up a name, and then when the pilots got a hold of it, they were afraid of it, more or less, I think. But actually, when it all boiled down to it, it had one of the best records of any of the planes flying in the war. It was one of the safest planes to fly during the war. And it was just a matter, I think, of getting used to it. It was a short-wing plane. It would stall out at 150, and in landing, you touched the runway at 110. Or you'd crash it. I mean, you flew it right into the runway. It was a hot airplane, in those days. And I think it was just a matter of people getting used to it, that's all. And because, personally, I liked it. Even though our first mission about scared me out, but it wasn't the plane's fault.
Now, so in your experience, you didn't witness or hear of too many training crashes, or you?
Training crashes, no. Very few. No. I was trying to think. No, because at Williams there, see, it was a pilot school. I know there were a couple of pilots cracked up, but as bombardiers, no. My main